A recent blog post in Psychology Today has reignited the debate about the wisdom of letting babies cry it out. That is to say, to let a baby cry until they soothe themselves and fall asleep instead of going to them and offering the soothing. Well, these days, crying it out, or at least some form of it, is a philosophy that's still in style. And our guest this hour says that letting babies cry it out can damage their brains and lead to anxious, troubled adults. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, our guest is Darcia Narvaez. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Notre Dame, and she writes The Moral Landscapes for Psychology Today. That's a blog. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this hour. Can you let your kids cry it out? Have you done that in the past, and how do you think it worked for you? And is it a baby's right to be soothed by a parent or a caregiver? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Darcia Narvaez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. It's Darcia.
Oh, Darcia, thank you very much.
Fine.
Sorry about that. Well, crying it out is a practice that's been in style off and on for decades. And these days, a lot of parents are relieved to use it to get a little bit of sleep. Can you give us a quick history of the philosophy and where it is today?
Well, it was started in part by John Watson, the behaviorist, who published a book in 1928. And he argued there that parents really should withhold affection from children because it will spoil them and ruin them and make them unpleasant people. And it was corresponding to the time period when the field of medicine was concerned about germs. And so there was this concern about touching children and spreading germs and all. And so it was advocated as parents began to give their understanding of parenting over to scientists. They succumb to this kind of advice.
And what about today? Because, I am a parent with young children. They're through the cry it out or the baby phase. But, just anecdotally, I know a lot of people are still using at least some form of crying it out. Is that how you perceive it, too?
Yes. My students, seniors in psychology, tell me, well, aren't you supposed to let babies cry? Because you can spoil them, can't you? Well, the truth is, if you know about human brain development, if you know about how babies best develop a personality and their whole body systems, you know it's a bad idea. We know a lot now from neuroscience and other studies that mammals who are left in distress when they're very young tend to have all sorts of health, mental health, physical health problems, as well as social problems.
Well, what is the evidence, then, that letting babies cry it out is bad for them?
Well, we know, first, I think we really have to take a shift in understanding what the baseline really is for early care. We've shifted away from what babies need, and now we're using emergency measures like infant formula or crying it out as regular everyday practices, and it's really doing a lot of harm. Babies are born 9 months early in comparison to other animals, because our heads are so big, we have to leave the womb a little early. And so they only have about 25% of their brain developed at full-term birth. The next 5 years of life, most of the brain is developed, and it's co-constructed by their experiences, especially by caregiver care. And what happens during that time is the threshold for most systems are set. How well the immune system works, how many neurotransmitters you have and how well they function, how well your vagus nerve functions, which affects all the systems of the body, what emotions will be dominant in your personality, how well they'll help you learn through life, and so on.
So I guess the idea is that if babies are left to cry it out, they work their brains and themselves up into such a state that they're sort of frying out some of these early developmental brain functions that they're going to need later.
That's right, yes. Cortisol is released during this crying out extensive distress, and it kills neurons and kills other cells that are needed for optimal functioning. And what can also happen is there's a sensitive period we know in mammals where responsive care turns genes on that help you alleviate anxiety later. These are lots of rat studies, and our brains are very similar to rat brains in many ways. So if you don't have a very nurturing mother during this, or parent, caregiver during this time period, you never turn that gene on to deal with stress. And so for the rest of your life, when you face new events, you get stressed out. And so there's epigenetic things going on in this early, in these early years that we've only just started now to identify.
I know that there have been times in American history, and I think the 1950s is such a decade, where it seemed like that was the prevailing wisdom. You let your baby cry it out, you put them to sleep on their stomach, and they learned how to sleep. And some of those mothers, you talk to them, and they say, because I did that, my kids sleep wonderfully. You put them in bed now, and they go right to sleep. And the idea, I guess, is that children learn how to go to sleep on their own, and they're not going to need, you know, the holding and the soothing. And that the kids who get all that will not be able to get themselves to sleep later on, maybe their whole lives.
There seems to be a logic to that, but it's still misunderstanding what babies need. Because when you separate a baby from a caregiver, their body is isolated from an adult body. All sorts of systems start to dysregulate. DNA synthesis stops. Growth hormone stops. The baby really goes into a static mode. And so babies can get conditioned to go into that mode, but it's not really good for them if you want an optimal, smart, happy child. You can get by with it, and it seems like we're going to kind of a Walmartization of parenting. Mm. How little can we do for kids, and they still survive, essentially? And my argument is that we need to develop optimal people. If we want our society to succeed, if we want to have happy adults, well-functioning people that get along with each other, we've got to pay attention to what babies need. And there's a whole set of practices, really, that we've kind of been abandoning.
You know what's interesting about that is, I mean, these days, a lot of times with two parents working, it can be really stressful during those early first months when the baby's crying. It's such a relief to read a philosophy like Crying It Out and to think, okay, I have permission from the experts to get some sleep. But I can imagine this putting a strain. We'll have to sort of rethink more than babies crying it out if that's what we need to do. We need to rethink maybe our work style and our lifestyle.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think it's really unfair to isolate mom and dad with the baby. They really need lots of support from grandma, grandpa, aunts, and uncles, which we've kind of dismantled over the last decade, the extended family support or community support. You can't take care of a baby 24 hours a day by yourself because they need you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be on the body of somebody to keep themselves regulated and to keep them growing. And so we really do need to rethink. We need to take babies to work, for example. And when babies are well cared for, they don't cry. We somehow have decided that's normal, just like we think moms getting depressed after giving birth is normal. It's not normal. It's normal for our society now. That's because so many things have shifted. All our baselines, understanding of child development, of parenting, of what we should be doing for kids has shifted.
Does this mean we need to reorient ourselves and maybe take a look again at attachment parenting, which is where you wear the baby and you have as much physical contact as possible?
Yeah, attachment parenting is the kind of thing we're looking at right now in my laboratory. And these practices, these have been identified as being practiced among peaceful societies in the past and in the present. But there are also practices that emerged more than 30 million years ago with the social mammals. So that's breastfeeding pretty on demand, frequently, through the night. And you can sleep well. Moms can actually sleep well when they do this, better than if they have to get up and get the formula together. And you breastfeed for a number of years. The range that's been identified among these ancestral kind of societies is 2 to 5 years.
2 to 5 years.
Right.
And what is the average in America? Well, isn't it something like 3 months?
Yes, something like that. Pretty low. Yeah. So
wow.
What that breast milk is doing, though, is it's building the immune system. It's got everything you need. It's got thousands of ingredients to build the brain, the body, to build serotonin receptors, for example. So you're less likely to get depressed and so on. And so when we don't give kids these things, then they have this deep sense that I think that they've lost something. There's something missing. They're always, their body never got quite put together appropriately. And so they have this yearning, probably. It sounds very psychoanalytic, but I think it's actually very physiological. Then another practice is touch, pretty much constant touch in the first years of life. Again, because they're growing so fast, every moment they're growing and growing and growing. You don't want to suddenly leave them alone at a critical point if some system is getting set up. You don't know what harm you're doing then. You want to keep them on somebody, and when they start to cry, it means something's wrong. Their body is not getting what they need at that moment. Another one, so that's breastfeeding, touch, responsive care. So responding to the needs of that child has been studied for a number of years in developmental psychology, and it's a given that you want to be a responsive parent because it's linked to so many positive outcomes for children and adults. If you have a responsive parent, you're more likely to be smarter, to be happier, to be more social, to have lots of skills and self-regulation. So that's breastfeeding, touch, responsivity. Another one is multiple adult caregivers. So it's not just mom, not just mom and dad. It's more than that. It's half the time in some of these societies, it's other people other than the mother taking care of that child.
I mean, I think that's what's so hard about this. What you're saying makes a lot of sense, and you've done the laboratory studies to back some of this up, and I'm sure more will emerge as you keep studying this. But our society isn't set up like that. People don't live with their extended families. And so, in essence, isn't this just going to place a tremendous burden on mothers who already are having trouble taking care of themselves and their families?
Well, I suppose information isn't – it's better – ignorance is bliss, I suppose, to some degree. But it's perpetuating more and more harm because each generation of low nurturing parenting is worse the following generation. According to the animal studies, the low-nurtured daughter is even less nurturing to her children.
Hmm.
And I think that's what's been happening over the last decade. And now we think it's normal to let babies cry, to keep them isolated and carriers most of the time instead of holding them most of the time, and so on. So I said breastfeeding, touch, responsivity, multiple adult caregivers. Another one is natural childbirth. We have the most interfering childbirth practices in the world, in the United States, and high infant and maternal mortality rates, in part because doctors interfere with the timing that the baby's arrival in various ways, by speeding up or slowing down labor, for example. And these interferences, like taking the baby away from the mother right after birth, are very harmful in terms of the what needs to happen for the bonding and for the initial breastfeeding, which and responsivity and kind of the relationship of the parent to the child, the mom and child. And then the last one that we're also studying is play, which is not so much for babies but for little older children, toddlers and all, and how important that is for self-regulation and avoiding ADHD problems. And we've been putting children in the situations where they get much less free play, self-directed free play, than in past decades. So I guess one recent study showed that parents allow their children to play outside, away from the house. The distance has shrunk to 1/9 of what it was in 1970. So they don't let kids very far away from the home, even though the crime rate's the same.
Hmm. Well, what is the difference between playing, you know, a couple blocks away versus playing in the backyard?
Well, children need to be able to roam around, be self-directed and follow their instincts. That's how they build their right brain and their sense of competence in the world and know their habitat in a way.
Hmm. Well, we're talking this hour with Darsha Navaris. She is Associate Professor of Psychology and Director of the Collaborative for Ethical Education at the University of Notre Dame and the author of Post-Conventional Moral Thinking. She writes the Moral Landscapes blog for Psychology Today. And this hour we're talking about crying it out and Darsha's research that it causes real damage to a baby's developing brain and that down the road this damage will result in a person who is anxious and has trouble with relationships, and there are also other health implications as well. And we'd love to know what you think. Did you let your kids cry it out? And what do you think about the idea of having a child who is soothed by the parent all through the night, who has that extra touch and attachment to the parenting that we have sort of fallen out of style in recent years. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we talk this hour about some new research that suggests that crying it out may actually hurt babies, and that what we need to do is have a return to attachment parenting and being hyper-responsive to babies' needs. And our guest is Darsha Narvaez. She is the blogger. She writes Moral Landscapes for Psychology Today, and we're talking about her recent article in that magazine. And we'll take our first phone call now. We have Laura with us in Appleton. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for this program. It's fascinating. And I wanted to just relate a very small amount of our experience with our daughter. She will be 3 in April, and she was born nearly 2 months prematurely in 2009. And so what most newborns exhibit to a certain degree, she exhibited kind of in a ramped up level. She needed to be held all the time. She cried a lot. You know, a lot of people would have called her a fussy baby, but the funny thing is I read a lot about attachment parenting at that time, and in kind of a rushed mode because she was born early and I didn't have time to do much of that before she was born. So while I was on leave and little snippets here and there, I would read bits about it, and I fundamentally disagree with letting children cry it out. I just, you know, I can't handle the stress of listening to a small baby cry for extended periods of time. It just does something to my stress level that I can't deal with. And, you know, they're crying because they need something. So what we were able to do eventually, I did have to rock her to sleep for about a full year when she would go to bed at night or nap. And around the time that she was 7.5 to 8 months old, she entered this phase, which was kind of a new frustration, where she seemed to really need to be in bed with me or with me and my husband to sleep at all at night. And, you know, of course, with all of the anti-co-sleeping campaigns,
right,
that was
yeah.
stressful. But by that point, she was older. She was able to roll over, and I wasn't as concerned about that sort of thing. But seriously, it was the only way she would go to sleep.
Yeah.
And then once she was asleep, I could then sometimes move her into her crib. Well, after she turned about a year, I think when she was about 13.5 months old, I decided to get serious about getting her into her own bed all night long rather than just for part of the night and sleeping through the night, because, you know, she's just really never done that, sleeping through the night. That's kind of a myth in our house, at least. So what I did is I continued to rock her to the point where she was almost asleep, and I would put her in her crib, and if she started to fuss, I just stayed by her side, rubbed her back, I talked to her in a gentle tone of voice, and I stayed there for as long as it took for her to calm down. And if I stepped away, she started to fuss again, I might pick her up for a few minutes, and we would repeat that procedure until she was able to fall asleep peacefully. And I, you know, it took a little time. I would say it took maybe a month before she was able to be put in the crib and calm herself, you know, to a point where she could sleep without my rocking her all the way. And we did, after she was maybe 14 or 15 months old, we did go through a phase of about a month where, you know, she cried a lot at night again because she knew that bedtime was coming and she was going to lose that contact with us. So at that point, I was a little bit more comfortable letting her cry for a short amount of time if she was in her crib. But I can't imagine allowing a newborn baby or a young baby to cry for an extended period of time, because, you know, not only is it stressful for them and I feel like a lousy parent, but it's stressful for me. So
right.
I just wanted to share that and reassure, you know, other parents, if you're in that phase of lots of crying and you're wondering if you're ever going to sleep again, it will happen with time, you know.
Your take was using a lot of those attachment parenting techniques that Dr. Sears is one proponent of those, I know, and his books are out there as well. But thank you so much for that call, Laura. What do you think about what Laura did, Darsha?
Well, I think she started off very well, and that's just what the baby needed to get everything off on the right foot, because we are dynamic systems in those initial months are really important for later outcomes.
so she established that wonderful attachment and the good beginning for all the systems in the body.
How long do you need to do this, I guess, is one question.
That's the question I'm not sure we know. If we look at our ancestors and what the mammalian brain needs, it really should be around age 3, maybe, that you might start to have more separation. But in most cultures of the world, families sleep together. We're kind of unusual. We have all sorts of unusual practices in terms of care, child care.
Okay, well, thank you for your call, Laura. And let's go next to Marianne in La Crosse. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I'm actually calling because I'm a stay-at-home mother, and I have a 16-month-old toddler who was similar to the last caller. He was born 6 weeks premature and came home after 2 weeks' stay in the hospital. And I started a habit early on of not just kind of gliding, using our glider and rocking him to sleep, but I also sing to him. And so lullabies is an important piece of, I guess, my attachment parenting with him. And really just his crib is in our room. He's still sleeping in our room. We feel like that's where he wants to be and we want him to be. But really a month ago, we've started, I guess, just wondering if, asking the question, how important is it that he learned to fall asleep on his own, and when, and how does that transition, can that transition happen?
Mm-hmm.
We often sing and rock him to sleep. Sometimes, similar to the last caller, we go through stages more recently where we can get him almost to sleep and put him in the crib, and he will fall asleep. If we try that when he's awake fully, he does cry a little bit, and so what we've been trying is we will stay in the room, and either my husband or I, and we continue to sing to him, just sitting on the bed next to his crib until he calms down and goes to sleep. And that time period has shortened now to, like, I don't know, 3, no more than 5 minutes. But I'm just, it's a question I have. How important is it that the child learn to fall asleep completely awake, and when? Because it is hard to listen to a crying child, and your instinct is saying, wow, is this really necessary? And might it be easier for the child than the parent at a later time?
Right. Okay, thank you, Marianne. And Darsha?
Well, I think this is a cultural question. It's like I said, most cultures around the world really don't force their children into sleeping by themselves and in their own rooms, for example. In fact, many of them, when they hear about that practice, think it's torturous and cruel. So it's really a cultural matter. I think the social pressure on families, on parents today is, you know, kids should be independent. And really, it's a misunderstanding of our brains and how they develop. We're born really self-focused. We're focused on survival. We have the reptilian brain right there ready, and that's what's crying for help. Because the sense of survival is at stake. And what has to happen then with parenting is you have to woo the child into being a social creature. You have to develop those pro-social kind of orientations to being compassionate and empathic and concerned for others. And you do that with lots of wonderful, warm attention. So in a way, we have things upside down. Kids are already born self-oriented, and you've got to woo them into being interdependent rather than independent.
That's interesting. Okay, well, thank you, Marianne, and good luck with your quest for sleep there. And Josh is next from La Crosse. Hi, Josh.
Hi. I was calling to say, when my daughter was first born, first off, the hospital was very adamant that we wouldn't give her a bottle, and my wife was having a hard time producing milk for breastfeeding. And it was just when we finally brought her home, it was just a lot of crying and crying for the first couple of days. And finally, we went out and got the bottle. She was fine. She slept. And then we started to kind of do the whole use a rocker to sleep her. And then we finally got a rocking swing. And that kind of scared us because she slept for like 4 hours then. Like, she just passed out. But it really soothed her. And well, I guess when it came to her turning about a year old, we're starting to kind of hear comments that she shouldn't be even sleeping in a rocker in the same room with us, that she should be in her own room. And, you know, that kind of felt weird to us, but we finally tried her on her own, sent her in her own crib, and the first night she passed out, didn't even make a noise, just rolled over. And it's continuously been like that ever since. Like, we've never had a problem with her crying at night. But, and that, and it just kind of leads me to what you guys are saying, that, you know, I've never once let her cry at night. I mean, if she cries, I automatically, and, you know, I'm a stay-at-home dad. I'm first response pretty much, so I let my wife sleep for work in the morning, and I'll never let her sleep. I'll do whatever I got to take, whatever it takes, but usually, you know, it's not that big a deal. But I just, I've heard, my wife told me of people that she knows that, you know, let their kid, and I'm talking like first few months of their life, cry at night, and I think that's unconscionable. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, the kids need, you know, one of three things, you know. Needs to eat, needs to change a diaper, or just needs you, you know.
Yeah.
They're not crying for attention or because they want something at that age. That it just, I don't see how somebody could just let their kid cry like that at that age.
All right. Well, thank you, Josh. And Darsha?
It's a great testimonial to the care that that you have there, Josh. That's marvelous. And it sounds like you're doing a lot of things right. And I should have said also for the previous caller, the singing and the rocking, those are wonderful things for young children. They, in our ancestral environment, babies were on the adults all the time, and so they were always rocking as adults did their work. They were tied on or something on their back. And so that's what they expect. Their brains expect all that movement. There's a great book called The Continuum Concept that discusses this and how it works for brain development and so on.
Do you have any suggestions about how to accomplish this if you come from a family where both parents work? Because I'm struck by several of our callers who were able to do the attachment parenting and to soothe on demand. They had one parent at least who was a stay-at-home. What if you don't have that?
Right. This is the challenge of our society today. And it seems that we have to change some of the structures and give parents parental leave, pay while they stay home, at least that first year when they establish all these thresholds for the child's life. And we need to set up our neighborhoods so that parents actually can help each other in different ways. Bring the extended family back.
So a lot of, I mean, you're talking about sweeping societal changes there.
Right. But we know if you breastfeed and feed through the night, that co-sleeping is not bed sharing. So co-sleeping is in the same room, bed sharing is in the same bed. That's a safe practice. The mother who breastfeeds is automatically in the right position so that the child is safe to do that. And you get enough rest. I mean, you don't get quite as much as you probably would like, but you get more rest.
So you're saying co-sleeping is safe, but bed sharing is not?
No, I'm saying bed sharing is actually a safe practice if you're breastfeeding.
If you're breastfeeding, okay.
It's when infants have formula. Formula is not meant for them to be. It doesn't get digested very well. And so it puts them in too deep of a sleep, which is not good for new babies. They need to be in this more lighter sleep, and they need to be fed the breast milk regularly because it's full of hormones that help their brain grow, especially at night. It's got tryptophan that helps the serotonin receptors grow, which is, again, related to not getting depressed. It makes them sleepy also. So if we just go back to our ancestral practices, kids will be happier, parents will be happier, they'll be less stressed later if they had all these practices as children.
Well, let's take our next caller. Bill joins us from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm not saying I disagree with what your guest is saying. I'd just like to inject a little bit of critical thinking by playing devil's advocate for a second. It from the title of your blog, as well as from what I've heard so far, it sounds like most of what you're saying is more about current cultural and political theory than it is about actual scientific evidence. And I guess my own anecdote is I watched my sister raise her son, and she definitely never let him cry, and she let him sleep in her bed with him until he was like in his teens. And he's now a virtual kaleidoscope of maladaption and dysfunction. Now, I don't know if that means anything, but I'm saying that does any of this research stand up to scientific rigor besides anecdotes and besides it sounds like the author has or the researcher has started out with a conclusion. You know, in other words, she already had an opinion about this issue, and then she designed the research to confirm her opinion. And that's absolutely backwards in terms of rigorous scientific
Well,
method.
let's hear what she has to say. We talked about some of this earlier on, but Darsha?
Well, it's true that our research is set up to figure out whether these ancestral parenting practices have an effect on children's development. My area is moral development, so that means empathy development, guilt, conscience, self-regulation. We also look at intelligence, aggression, depression. And so we are finding, right, a recent study that we've done is over 3 years of time that kids who get responsive care, for example, have less depression, less aggression at age three. They're smarter, their intelligence scores are higher, and they have better self-regulation. Now, we came up with this idea to do the research from lots of reading, because a lot of people don't realize how much the brain and the body are shaped during early life. So you have to read across all sorts of different areas of research on immune system development, brain development, vagus nerve development. So it takes a broad sweep of research understanding to actually come up with this idea to do the research. But research is always about following hunches and testing them out, and so that's what we're trying to do now.
Okay, well, Bill, thank you for that call. And let's take a break now. We're talking with Darsha Narvaez. She is Associate Professor of Psychology at Notre Dame University, and she writes the Moral Landscapes blog for the magazine Psychology Today. We're talking about her recent blog post citing research that says crying it out may harm babies in the long run in terms of their brain development and their social adaptation as adults. And we're wondering what you think. Did you let your children cry it out, or didn't you? And how did that work out for you? And is it a baby's right, maybe, to be soothed by a parent or a caregiver? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. And coming up later on this hour, actually, so I should say next hour, 10 o'clock, we'll be celebrating the life and work of Shel Silverstein with guest Marv Gold. And at 12:30, join us for Chapter a Day as Carl Schmidt is reading from An Irish Country Christmas by Patrick Taylor. This hour, we're talking about attachment parenting and crying it out, and maybe a sea change according to some new research that crying it out could harm babies down the road. Our guest is Darsha Narvaez, and she writes the Moral Landscapes blog for Psychology Today magazine. And we have an email next from Carolyn who says, could you please address the gender imbalance in attachment parenting? Hardly anyone does. And there's a huge stigma to breastfeed past 6 months in the U.S., depending on the area. I'm a working mom with a full-time job who breastfeeds my 13-month-old and wore her early and did not let her cry it out. She's very calm, and I think it's also her personality. But one of the big issues is that this kind of parenting is incredibly demanding and still falls on women. What if you want to have a career? And what if you don't want to breastfeed all night, as many attachment parents do? And Darsha?
Well, I think that is an excellent point. In the ancestral environment, which I keep referring to, moms and dads took care of the child almost equally, except for the breastfeeding, of course. But in that circumstance, you didn't separate from the family to go to work. So with industrialization and taking people out of their homes instead of working at home, we've created this conundrum that if you breastfeed, then women have the extra burden. So there are some families that pump their breast milk, and then the father can administer it or give it to the baby also. But still, there is an extra burden on the mother. So I think, again, that we have to change our workplaces to allow moms to bring babies to work, and there's a nice organization that's trying to do that by that name, Babies at Work. And then we have to just rethink the way we have society structured. So part of my Moral Landscape blog is to suggest new ways of thinking, alternative perspectives, so that we start to rethink what we're doing.
Okay, well, thank you for the email, Carolyn. Appreciate that. And we move next to Erin. You're next in Viroqua. Hi, Erin.
Hi. I just wanted to share my story. I have a five-year-old son, and he is still co-sleeping or bed-sharing. We have a family bed, and he nursed until he was three. I wore him until he was probably, he stopped asking to be worn when he was three. We've co-housed with different families. We once lived in a co-op in Madison with 30 other people. I've tried to do pretty much everything. Attachment, the continuum concept was amazing. I love that book. And I just wanted to say that it's not easy. It's not easy, but it's your baby. And I don't know, my instincts always told me that, you know, what was right, and I did it, and I kind of always just stumbled upon, you know, Dr. Sears or, you know, there's a lot of authors that I can't think of the names right now, but I wanted to say that to both parents working, I went back to work when Huck was 4 months old. I was a nanny, and I made $8 an hour. And that was whatever. I still make $8 an hour because instead of continuing, you know, my school and my college, I was raising my son. And 5 years later, and that's a big deal, but I don't regret it. I've nannied a lot, actually, and I just wanted to say that, you know, it can be done. You have to be creative, and sometimes it does take sacrifice, but my son is so happy. He didn't cry at all, and he's, like, this beautiful, sweet, calm 5-and-a-half-year-old now, and I'm really glad that I did things the way that we did.
Okay, well, thank you, Erin. And Erin's someone who found creative ways to fulfill the attachment parenting goals that she had. What do you think, Darsha?
Oh, I think that's wonderful. Thank you for the testimonial, encouragement to all of us.
Okay, well, thank you, Erin. And we go next to John, who is joining us from Neillsville. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you today?
Doing well, how are you?
Good. Say, I was listening to this. I have 7 kids. And I have one in Madison, one in Green Bay, 2 in Stevens Point, one that's already graduated, plus 2 that are very successful. We let them cry themselves to sleep. If they have a wet diaper, they're sick, they're hungry, like that. You know, those are natural things for kids. And my feeling is if every time they cry, you pick them up, you know, just not stress them out or whatever the case may be. All they're going to learn is every time they cry, they're going to get catered to and nurtured, and I don't think that's very good for their development. I don't necessarily think that, that crying themselves to sleep is necessarily bad for them. I'm sure Einstein's mom didn't pick them up every time they squawked or whatever the case may be. So I don't necessarily buy into the fact that that's harmful at all for the children. I know for our kids, they're all brilliant and they're going to college, and we never did that with them. So I'm just not buying into that.
And John, would you say that your children seem happy and well adjusted too?
Absolutely, they do wonderfully. None of them smoke. They don't do drugs. They don't go to bars. You know, they. We always gave one. If one got, they all got. If one didn't get, none of them got. They learned the value of a dollar, and they bought their own cars with their own money. Worked since they were 15. Bought their own insurance. I'm just not buying into that. Every child is different. You know, and every home situation is different. The environment has a lot to do with how you raise your children and how they behave in that environment, how they take that into the real world. So you know, I'm just. I think it's all in, you know, if they squawk and you pick them up all the time, they're going to just learn that. You know, every time they fuss a little bit, mom or dad's going to pick them up, and next thing you know, the kid's still awake at 10, 11 o'clock at night because you don't want them to cry because you're afraid it's going to ruin their, you know, just have something to do with their brain. You know, they're going to develop naturally regardless, and, you know, if you nurture them in a loving, kind environment, they're going to be fine whether they cry themselves to sleep or not.
Okay, well, thank you for your call, John. Appreciate that. And John saying maybe this is overblown and we're being a little too scrupulous about the nurturing aspect.
Well, he did say at the end, if you raise them in a loving, caring environment.
Right.
So,
but he did let his children cry it out at night.
Right. Depends on how old they are, I suppose, and how much that matters for their development. And like he said, though, every family's different, every situation's different, so... These are general principles, and people have to apply them in their own case. So he's raising a good point because you really have to pay attention to the particular child and what that child needs at the time. And some kids at different ages need different things. So,
well, what if, as John says, what if you are super attentive to your child during the day? Maybe you nurture them and you pick them up when they cry and you soothe them during the day, but at night it's a different story.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Right, and I think probably it depends. But also every squawk, like you said, you don't want to get them to have you run to them every time they squeak either, especially, you know, when they're having the more of the, especially if it's a temper tantrum kind of thing, so... But I'm talking about babies, so.
Mm-hmm. You're talking more about babies. But I'm saying, according to your research, do you think that that would be a viable middle ground to be nurturing, to maybe do attachment parenting during the day, but at night do a little bit more crying it out?
Well, I still would be reluctant to do that. The reason that crying is so irritating to adults is because we evolved to pay attention to crying to prevent it, and also to prevent it because the predators would come and get the children. So they'd be pretty, they'd know exactly where we were. So you don't want babies to cry in that ancestral environment. And we evolved to not allow that to happen. So if you start the baby out with lots of attention and close care, they're not going to be a crying baby like we've heard from several parents.
Okay, well, thank you for your call, John. And we move to Joey calling from Downers Grove. Hi, Joey.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm good. My question, not so much related to infants, per se. I'm in a relationship with a girl that I've been with for 9 months. Love her to death. Her son is great. He's 10. But he watches TV all night in his room. Like, if the TV is on and the light on in his room, and it drives me bananas. Because I think I was raised, you know, lights out, it's time to go to bed, shut it off, everything's, you know, shut down for the night. But is that healthy for a child to have the TV on all night, every night, no matter what?
I'll see if our guest knows anything about that. Darsha?
Well, one thing I do know is that you don't want to sleep with any lights on because the melatonin production occurs in the dark. And melatonin production through the night, 7, 8, or 8 hours of it, is a cancer prevention mechanism because it releases agents that clean up cancerous cells during the day, the following day. So, and there's been studies of night shift workers and how they have higher incidences of different kinds of cancer. So, in general, you don't want to have the light on. And there are other things that happen that kind of rewire the brain, so you have a hard time ever really resting deeply if you've got that flashing TV light on.
You know, I'm reminded of an interview we did maybe last year. The author, Joey, was George Prochnik, Prochnik, I believe. And he had a book about silence and something about what goes on in the brain at night when you've got noise happening. Mm. So it might be worth checking out and reading a little bit more about that. I'm guessing he's coming down pretty hard on the pro-silence side, but there might be some research to back that up. So anyway, I hope that helps you, Joey. And we'll go next to Kelly in Aaron, Wisconsin. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling a little bit on both sides of the fence, some with some observations of my own that I wonder if you could help me back up, I guess, to reaffirm what I feel with science. That's always a nice confirmation. But I have seven children, all of whom I've breastfed and birthed naturally. And I suppose I want to just comment that what works for one family might not work for another because there are just so many factors. What John was saying about not letting them have a tantrum and not spoiling them in a way and things like that is very true. However, you can look at another family and see where the mother is just not nurturing at all because she feels that science is telling her that it's okay to let the child cry and cry and cry until they end up in the emergency room, not even noticing that the child has a serious issue. And that's a problem. So sometimes in this, like you said, Walmartized culture that we're getting to, when you haven't been around your mother watching her nurture a child or been around a grandmother or an aunt, we just don't know what to do, and we're too afraid to listen to our own instincts. And so that mother just didn't know that it was okay to run to that child when she was crying. And, you know, we have to have sympathy for them in that way, even though that's exactly the opposite of the way I raise my children. But I guess I'm just kind of wondering, too, if have you done any studies about along the lines of breastfeeding to understand that the mother's diet has a lot to do with the quality of the breast milk and that the baby may not be getting everything they need from the breast milk? I guess that's one question. And then also just realizing, too, that unless you have the support of a family network, it really is hard to do, to answer your body, to drop everything to go and run to that child. Even though that is what I do, it can be very stressful when you're the only one doing it, of course. And so what do you find that are the substitutes for that? I mean, is it enough to say that you've done lab work to say, look, we say that this is the right thing, so keep on doing it, even though your mother, your mother-in-law, your sisters don't confirm this? Do you find that that's enough, that that's supportive enough? What are we going to do about that? But just the question about the breast milk, about the insufficiencies in breast milk. What diet do you recommend most?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Kelly. Darsha?
Yeah, good question. In terms of the breast milk, there are certain foods that we're not getting enough of these days. One of them is fish oil. So DHA and other ingredients like that are missing. Also, vitamin D from breast milk because mothers aren't getting enough sunlight. So there are certain, and the vitamin D is related to all sorts of health benefits. So there are certain things that are missing, and I've been reading just recently, because I'm writing a book on these things, that there is some concern that mothers who don't have a good diet may not provide good breast milk for their children. Although I've also heard from my lactation consultant friend that it doesn't matter what the mother eats because the mother's body will produce good milk. So there's some evidence on both sides, I think. In terms of lack of social support around you, I think that's a critical issue. And what I do is I encourage people to go online then. Thank goodness for the Internet, the World Wide Web, because you can find support groups there. It's not the same thing, I know, but at least it gives you places to look and chat with people who are having these issues or questions, and you can get some at least moral support there.
Okay, well, Kelly, thank you so much for your call, and I hope that that helped answer your questions. And I think maybe we have time for one more caller here. Karen in Cottage Grove, you're next.
Oh, hello. Hi, Veronica.
Oh, hi, Karen.
I am calling. It's a good segue from what your guest just said, because my children are actually like mid-20s to early 30s, and I found when I was raising them when they were babies that the La Leche League was a spectacular local support group, and it was a way of making very good connections and friends with other women who were very much into nurturing parenting. And one of the other items that really stuck out for me, even years ago, I remember reading that babies' brains develop, they need that light REM sleep, and that when you feed a baby formula, the reason babies sleep longer and often sleep through the night earlier is because basically they're, I don't know, I guess knocked out by the heaviness of the formula.
And Karen, I'm going to let our guest respond. We're almost out of time, but thanks, Karen.
Okay.
Excellent points there. La Leche League is great. Holistic Moms is another network that's around the country that can be a support group. And right, formula has all sorts of issues that it's really an emergency food. It shouldn't be the regular first choice for feeding a baby because of those issues and others.
Well, Darsha, we are about out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us this hour.
You're very welcome, and thank you.
Darsha Navais, our guest this hour. She is Associate Professor of Psychology and Director of the Collaborative for Ethical Education at the University of Notre Dame and co-author of Post-Conventional Moral Thinking. And she also writes the Moral Landscapes blog for Psychology Today. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning. She took your phone calls and produced this hour's program. And I'm Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.